bil-qala u l-moqdif. Zjajja storiċi ta' personalitajiet imgħoddija l-Gżejjer Maltin. ċad xwire pora mikrofonu nilqakom għall-edizzjoni oħra ta' silsila bil-qala u l-moqdif. Illum nistgħu ngħidu li se niltaqgħu ma' persuna li se jkellimna fuq karattru u t-tnej li huma ma tantx huma mitħla tagħna l-Maltin għall-inqas sal-lum. Nittama li din tinbidel mhux biss wara l-programm imma wkoll wara pubblikazzjoni bl-isem James Martin, The Maltese Adventurer ta' Dr. Mark Pulicino li ġiet stampata s-sena l-oħra għall-ewwel darba l-Ingilterra u pubblikata qasma Malta mill-Book Distributors Limited. Il-BDL. Jiena kelli ċans nitkellem ma' Dr. Mark Pulicino, Malti li għadta ħafna mill-ħajja tiegħu isegwi karriera barra l-pajjiż u illum jinsab irtirat Malta. Tajjeb li taqsmu miegħi dak li għandu xi jgħidilna dwar dan l-avventurier Malti u fl-istess waqt ukoll ikellimna dwaru innifsu l-awtur. Għalkemm l-awtur huwa Malti tant għadta snin barra minn hawnhekk u anke rċieva l-edukazzjoni tiegħu dejjem barra minn Malta li kif se tisimgħu ħass li iktar ikun komdu jitkellem bl-Ingliż. Niltaqgħu ma' Dr. Mark Pulicino. Huwa pjaċir tiegħi niltaqa' kif afżajt fil-bidu tal-programm ma' Dr. Mark Pulicino li għal ħafna mis-semmija tagħna hija persuna ġdida. Hija persuna li forsi ftit smajna dwara u għalhekk se jkollna pjaċir insiru nafu aħjar, imma jiena wkoll sibt l-iskuża niltaqa' miegħu minħabba li huwa l-awtur ta' ktieb riċenti bl-isem James Martin, The Maltese Adventurer. U anke fuq da, James Martin, ftit li xej smajna sissa. Ġifiri, illum se jkollna l-okkażjoni nitaqgħu ma' żewġ personaġġi, it-tnejn Maltin, li kważi ftit li xejn nisimgħu dwarhom. Il-fatt li hemm pubblikazzjoni issa żgur se tkun introduzzjoni tajba ta' James Martin, se tkun introduzzjoni sabiħa wkoll tal-awtur li illum għandu pjaċir aċċetta li jitaqgħu magħna. I know we will be talking mostly in English.
Iva, iva.
Tiftakar xi ħaġa bil-Malti issa ngħidu għalik.
Grazzi, Charles, tal-li stedintni fil-programm tiegħek. Jien kont ngħix barra minn Malta ħafna snin u il-Malti tiegħi mhux tajjeb ħafna. Naħseb aħjar niftehmu bil-Ingliż. Nispera tajjeb għalik.
Ħadd gost li l-isforz tiegħek ġenwin bil-Malti ċar ħafna u jieħdu gost dak jissemmijaw japprezzaw. Tix ngħidulhom għaliex why is this so? Għaliex il-Malti tiegħek mhuwiex tajjeb daqs l-Ingliż tiegħek u inti għadek kemm għad li kont qed tgħix barra. Asking you Maltese perhaps offend on.
My father, who was Maltese, left Malta when I was 1 year old. I was born in Imdina. And so I've lived abroad. We came back for holidays all the time, but early upbringing was in East Africa, in Zanzibar.
How come? Your father was working there?
Well, my father worked for the British administration in Malta initially, and then he was given a post in East Africa. And so he took the whole family there. And
with
so,
the British services, I imagine.
Not the services, the administration,
okay,
the secretary.
The civil service.
Yes. So that's why we lived in East Africa, and then after my schooling, he came back, my father came back to Malta, and he lived in Malta, and then I went to university in Scotland.
How did you connect with James Martin? Because you're saying that you studied overseas.
Yes.
I also noticed that your PhD you got from Berlin, right, later. How come you sort of got the bug, your father's bug, your career, took you more overseas than in Malta. Was this perhaps the influence from your childhood?
Well, yes, I think so. You obviously, having traveled abroad, you see different places, and it's just opportunity. I wanted to study in England, and I studied there, and then I worked for a short time in Malta, and then went back to study in Britain again. At the time, I then got a job in Berlin.
That explains why you studied there.
I then studied there as well, so I learned the language, and it was more where the winds of fortune blew you rather than anything else.
Yeah. But your stage became the world rather than Malta.
Yes, where I lived. I mean, we always came back to Malta. You know, there wasn't always work in Malta, as you know. Now it's a lot better.
Now you're settled in Malta?
Yes, now I've been back 4 years with my wife, and we're very happy and settled here. But, I mean, my story is very much like many Maltese. They've left and they've come back.
Today we have many Maltese working abroad, not always as migrants, but also just because they prefer to find somewhere else, more profitable, perhaps, challenging careers. A few hundreds are in Brussels, for example, working in the EU. Would you think that people who spend a few years, Maltese people who are brought up even in Malta, most of them were brought up in Malta anyhow, in a small insular place, insular within quotes. But would you think that once you start working, spreading your wings in a bigger country, it would be difficult to adapt back home, again in a smaller environment?
No, I don't think so. I think a Maltese, when they go abroad, they're always Maltese in identity. They remain that way. And they always like to come back here. There's the family, you know, there's such a nice way to live here and people are friendly. So there's always that pull back to Malta. But I think people going away, as it's explained in the book, because James Martin had to leave Malta, there's a push and a pull. Some people are pushed away from Malta because they have to find jobs. And certainly in the 1800s, that was the case. A lot of Maltese had to leave because they couldn't feed
their
families.
North Africa, for example.
Yes. And the other thing is the pull away from Malta to other opportunities. You know, some people want to, I mean, the Maltese are very talented, so they want to test these cultural talent they have in the languages and things in another environment. And they do that, and they're successful, usually.
One last take on your own history before we move on to James. There are historical roots to the Maltese people. Malta is very rich in its history. It's very small but strategically placed.
Yes.
We seem to accumulate a lot of historical episodes and periods. And your surname, Pulicino, brings to mind one of your ancestors, Pulicino, Pietro Paolo Pulicino of the 19th century. You are a relative of Pulicino?
That's right, yes. Canon Paolo Pulicino was the brother of my great-great-grandfather. He was a canon and a priest, and in fact, I have a picture of him hanging up in my in my house, okay, which I'm very proud of.
Yes, he was director of education under the British in the 19th century. Right?
He was director of the education. I think further than that, he was perhaps one of the first Maltese to actually start common education for all the Maltese, and he started teaching, if I'm not mistaken, Maltese, written in Italian. But he was the one that really kicked off education from the Maltese.
The 1870s, around there.
So it's very significant because before Malta could become democratically autonomous, the basis is education. And when he started in education about the 1860s, it wasn't till another century till we got democratic independence. So it takes time, but the basis was the education, which he was quite instrumental in putting together. So I'm proud of that background, you know, that we have in the family.
Let's move now on James Martin. We know very little about him, but the minute you say James Martin is Maltese, although Martin or Martin is a surname in Malta. It still exists in Malta, most probably. It was imported from the south of France in the 18th century, most probably. But why James Martin? It sounds so English. How come he is a Maltese?
His Maltese name is Antonio Martini. And at the age of 16, he left Malta to work on British ships. And that was in the 1870s, around that time. And in those days, when you worked on a British ship, you tended to take a British name.
Instead of Giorgio, they call you George. Obviously, but yes. Also the surname?
Yes. In case of Martini, he was called Martin, which is easier. There's a very good, well-known Maltese sailor, Ruggier, who was known as Rogers.
Charles Dickens wrote about him.
That's right. But his name, his English name was Rogers, and when he came back to Malta, his name then was Ruggier. So that seemed to be the done thing in those days. That was part of the culture at the time. Yeah.
And it was convenient for British officials to call you in their own language.
That's right. There was more assimilation. I suppose you felt you got closer to their culture and got to know them better. Yes.
And for the individuals, for the Maltese themselves, I imagine they fitted more into the ambience. They didn't stick out as different people from the rest.
Yes, that's right. They adapted, and I think that's one thing Maltese are good at doing, is adapting. And that's what he did, and that was part of the ritual of adapting, I suppose, and getting on with it.
You speak in the book about his infancy, about his childhood, also about his constraints. James wasn't just an ordinary boy, so to speak. You describe him as very adventurous and intelligent, but at the same time he had some handicaps. How could we describe him?
That's right. Well, he was illiterate, and it's always been told throughout the reports of him that he couldn't read or write.
Which was very common at
the time. Which was common, yes. But it was not common for someone who was really quite intelligent. He spoke several languages. He had the gift of languages. And in the end, he spoke as many as 10 languages.
Picking them up.
And remembering them. Really, with exactly. Sharp memory. So it's strange. I asked the question, why is he illiterate? And I wrote that there was a previous edition to this, and a doctor picked it up and said, you know, Martin is dyslexic. What you're describing in the book are the symptoms of dyslexia. So in the book, I went into the whole mental problems of a dyslexic, that they have to basically formulate images that aren't properly
formulated. Rely on their memory as well.
And rely on their memory and find ways around, for example, he had to find ways around writing numbers because his dyslexic mind couldn't read them. Yeah. So he's quite ingenious in the way he coped with life, although he had dyslexia. And often dyslexia, there's a negative, but there's also a positive. A lot of dyslexic are geniuses.
Artists as well.
They say Einstein was a dyslexic and Walt Disney. His gift was languages and a memory.
He made full use of them, in fact.
Yes.
When he decided to leave Malta, he was quite young. He was a teenager. But before he leaves the Cotonera area, where he was brought up, you describe also his observations of the environment around him, the social milieu he was brought up in. And I think that had influenced him enough for most of the rest of his life. Could you, perhaps for the sake of the listeners, tell us something about these visions he had before?
He came from a very humble, poor family from Marsa, and he obviously had the gift of languages, Italian, from his father's
which he
Italian
picked from
Maltese.
Sailors, perhaps, an Italian. Martini is an Italian name after all.
His father was of Italian ancestry. And so he picked that up. He picked up a bit of English. I think he initially worked as a sailmaker. I think they started when they were about 7, 8 years old, sewing sails, which was a big industry in Malta at the time.
Like rope making and things like that.
He came from a working class environment, and I think he must have felt there were a lot of social blocks to his ability to do anything. He was quite ambitious. He had a lot of pride in what he could do, but Malta at the time in the 1850s was quite, I think, dominated by the British government and nobility. I mean, you needed to read and write.
It was a must. If you don't know English, you can't even get an employment.
He wasn't part of that elite, or that minority. Mm-hmm. And so I think the book describes a little the different social milieu of the nobility and the working class and the general traditions in Malta at the time. And I think he felt, well, he'd like to do something else, test his abilities in the world.
He had a sense of adventure, must have.
Yes,
had.
Exactly.
Ah! the scene which you describe when he was once called to visit a house of an aristocrat of those days. It seems to have struck you as his biographer, but also struck him, it must have, when comparing his low social level to others who owned big houses, villas, and had decorations inside, which he wouldn't have dreamt of having at his age anyhow.
That's right. I mean, this is the anomaly. Particularly in the 1850s, you have very poor homes. Yes. And then you have the very smart, large palaces, which is sort of remnants from the knights in Malta with the nice furniture and the history behind the furniture and the families. And so I put him together with one of the nobility who was alive at the time, a real person, and I thought back to see how they lived, how their house was furnished, and how they would interact with Martini. I mean, this is a little bit of fiction. I don't know if they ever met these people, but they could have met. And if they would have met, this is properly the social milieu. But I think it's important to get a feeling. The book's written more as a thriller, not a sort of dry biography. So I wanted to understand the social milieu he lived in and the conflicts, you know, the church, the nobility, the British administration, and the Maltese, you know, all their different conflicts. Because these were things that influenced him to stay or leave, which they influenced all people at the time.
We could move a bit further, maybe only leaving the very last part of the book for the curiosity of the listeners so that they would read the book as well. I mean, we should invite them to do so, in fact. But it's good to explain what happened when he decided to go on board ship. How was the decision taken? I mean, he was part of a Maltese family, but it was a time when everybody was seeking some employment overseas, or at least with the services that would take him somewhere else. But everybody was hungry for a good job, for an income, more than anything else. How come he decided so early in his life to do so, and where did that take him?
Well, he had, at an early time, when he was just beginning as a teenager, he was a proficient sailmaker, so he could make and sell sails.
It was one big plus.
At that time, the old ships were sails, were just beginning to bring steam
to steam.
They just opened the Suez Canal at the time. So a lot of Malta opened up as a major world port because ships used to come through Malta.
En route.
Down the canal to India and so on. So there were more opportunities, and being a sailmaker, his father was a seaman as well. So he obviously got contacts, got on a ship and went on a ship. And he then, in his sailing career, he had two shipwrecks. And there's one really horrendous account, which is documented in the Royal Geographic Society, of him being shipwrecked and just being lost in the sea on his own. And then eventually he...
Whereabouts?
In the Red Sea, as he was going down the Red Sea towards, I suppose, towards...
Having passed through the Suez Canal, yes, most probably, and out near Somalia nowadays.
That's right, yes. And he was then picked up by a British ship, HMS London, and he was just found in the water, you know, in the middle of the sea. So it's amazing. It's almost a miracle.
It's almost destiny.
He seems to have been very lucky in his... He did a lot of things. But then eventually had another shipwreck and just off Zanzibar. So he was brought to Zanzibar from the shipwreck, and that's where he started his career in Africa. He decided not to go back to sea anymore.
Because it was not such a nice experience.
He didn't have too much luck in that, yeah. That's right.
But it also, upon reflection, one could also say that nowadays we are witnessing so many Africans, especially East Africans, coming also to Malta, not necessarily from the East, because there is Australia as well over there. This was a case in reverse. It's a Maltese going down to East Africa and being saved there to live there in future.
Well, it's a very interesting thing that you're saying, because today it has a whole different connotation. But he went there and he was accepted. And he was accepted not only for himself, but his language. Speaking Maltese, there are a lot of Arab traders in Zanzibar at the time. Actually, it was slave trader and ivory and things. With his Maltese, he spoke Arabic. But then he found that with his Maltese, he could actually speak Swahili, which was the language. and there are several Maltese words identical in Swahili.
Semitic language.
Yes, through the Arabic. Some of the counting in Swahili is the same as Maltese, which would surprise a lot of people. So the cultures there are not so very far away. And now we're having an influx. Obviously, there are a lot of reasons and connotations to it, but it is interesting to understand the people of Africa, their culture, their language, and where they come from. I think the Maltese trait to communicate, to speak to people in their own language, was his secret of success. Because
it's communication. He had the gift of communication.
That's right. Now, you can imagine in East Africa, a British official with a university education talking to the local people, trying to administer them. And you can then imagine Martin, who spoke their language.
At the same level.
He knew why they laughed. You know, he really communicated with them, and he made friends with them. And that was his secret to success. Now, I think that's a sort of Maltese cultural DNA, if you like.
Yeah, it's a trait. Yeah,
a trait, yes.
We managed to communicate at all levels with all kinds of people. I think as well we do not threaten anybody. Malta is part of the European Union, rightly so. But again, we are very close and friendly with Arab nations.
That's
because
right.
of the language, for example, as well. But we seem to adapt very quickly to
That's
everybody,
right.
also because we don't threaten anyone.
Yes, so it gives us a very powerful situation, actually. We're very flexible in that way and a plus to the future, yes. But the things, Martin, I mean, we're talking about Martin as a Maltese, but if I could just focus on the main things that I think, the things, I mean, can identify Martin and his life is, one is one of the main roads in Kampala, which is the capital of Uganda, is called Martin Road.
For him?
For him, yes. It's named after him. In the center of the old city.
How come he became so important to Kampala?
Well, he lived there a long time and he was liked by the Buganda. There was genuine communication and they named the road after.
The Buganda would be the majority tribe.
The majority tribe of Uganda,
right?
Yes, around Kampala. Mm-hmm. Whether he helped instigate the name of the road, I don't know. Or whether they put it together themselves after he died, I'm not too sure.
In recognition to his
But
presence.
The fact is, his name, Maltese, is named after a road in a city with 1.6 million inhabitants today. So that's a legacy. Another legacy is a camp he founded called Martin's Camp became Nairobi. So he set up a camp in Kenya, in Nairobi.
He founded the city.
He founded, you could say he founded the city, which is now a city of 3 million inhabitants. So these are legacies which I don't think any other Maltese have. Another thing, which if you go into the book, is a very interesting incident. One of his treks into Africa. Martin started in Africa about 7 years after Livingstone died. So he was...
The famous Livingstone.
Yes.
The explorer.
So, that's right. So it was very early days in the exploration of Africa. And one of Martin's expeditions with a Scotsman called Joseph Thompson was to discover the eastern shores of Lake Victoria, which they did. They were the first Westerners to go there. And that is the tribe of the Luo tribe of Obama. So
the American president.
The American president, yes. So you can say when Martin arrived, it was about the time that Obama's grandfather was born. So you could say that if Martin, Maltese Martin, hadn't gone to Lake Victoria, Obama wouldn't be president. I mean, you can debate whether that would be the fact. But I mean, it is a whole process that was set in motion.
Because Martin helped that community to settle there.
Yes. And then, well, he helped set up, then eventually people came in, there was education set up, and then Obama's father went to school there. And Obama's father got a scholarship to America. He married an American, Obama's mother. And the rest is history, really.
You should send a copy of the book to the American president.
Well, actually, I gave a copy to the ambassador.
There you are, yes.
She found it very interesting, so maybe.
Martin being white in a community where the whites were the colonialists or officials, British, German at times there, Lake Victoria, for example. Did that help him? Did it deter him in his adventures? It doesn't seem to be. You keep talking so well about his closeness to local tribes who are all black. Yet he was white and considered almost as one of them.
Yes.
He has this ambivalent convenience, sort of, being very close to the blacks, being very close to the whites because of his color.
He had the advantage of being white, because in those times, the 1850s, there was tremendous respect for the whites and the white culture.
The new explorers.
Yes, and all the things they brought with them, unfortunately the guns, but all the different technologies, and they certainly were well respected. They eventually became administrators of the South, the Germans in the South initially, and the British in the North. So he's part of that. But he was then also able to talk to people in their own language. So they really must have felt a double affinity for him.
Yeah. Truly Maltese. You know, how to communicate with the ones on top and the ones
absolutely,
below.
Absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. And he was working around his dyslexia and his illiteracy. And I think he found that the Africans, they're all illiterate, of course, and at that time, they tended to communicate in the same way.
Yeah, and he felt at ease with them, no complexes, sort of.
Yes.
Bil-qala u l-moqdif. Illum, Mark Policino, l-awtur tal-ktieb James Martin, The Maltese Adventurer, qed jintroduċilna lil dan il-karattru avventurier Malti tas-seklu 19. Komplu simgħu bil-qala u l-moqdif.
You also speak at length about his career as a guide. It seems he made a name for himself by guiding explorers, groups of explorers, most of them British, Europeans, into unknown territory, the jungle and the spaces which were not explored yet. It seems he gained a lot of respect for this.
That's right. A trek leader, he used to organize caravans of people which were just porters, and you had, say, 200-400 porters.
Huge groups.
Yes. In a line to carry supplies either to Uganda or else to go on hunting expeditions, which some of these rich Americans did. In fact, they came over at the time, it was the very beginning, they came over to hunt wild game.
And carrying trophies
with
them to their homes.
Take the trophies back with them. So the book does go a bit into the wildlife in Africa and a bit about how it is as a white hunter, probably could have been called the first white hunter in Africa, which is a sort of a profession there. So that makes things very interesting, and he had some adventures in that. A friend of his was gored by a buffalo, and he helped him, brought him back to health. One of his expedition climbed Kilimanjaro, which was probably one of the first climbings of Kilimanjaro, although it's not properly documented, which today everybody climbs, you know, it's a tourist thing
today.
Yeah,
it's an attraction today.
Although I don't think Martin did climb the mountain. Another interesting thing is when he went into Africa, he set up a camp called Taveta. He bought a piece of land, which he bought from the chief. He got to know the chief, and he paid the chief something, and the chief gave him a piece of land. So he set up a camp there. So when he took his people into interior of Africa, they stopped off at Taveta and then went on further. And in 1886, when Britain and Germany agreed to divide the land between the German South and the British North, they drew a line over 1,000 miles, and it went to Kilimanjaro and then south. Now, if you look at that line, Taveta would have been just inside in the German sphere, so Martin would have lost his property.
Of course.
But if you look at the very line closely, there's a little blip in the line. And from a very straight line for 500 miles, it goes round
just for
and
him.
Back again, just for him. So we have an example here of where he managed to change international borders, get his property into British into British land.
Truly a Maltese guy down there. You can't trust him with things like that.
Ingenuity, yeah.
Exactly.
became later on in life an official of British administration.
That's right.
Which is a big achievement for a person who is illiterate, who suffers from dyslexia, himself not in command of military skills, perhaps.
That's right. He was, initially, he was in these caravans. He was in the British East Africa Company, which was the sort of company exploiting Africa at the time, or trading in Africa. And then that turned into the British administration. So from one day to another, he became a British administrator. And he was given
a piece of land. As well,
eh? Well, yes, yes, certainly. He had a lot of influence in the time. Particularly that he could communicate with the Africans, which a lot of the British administration couldn't. And he was given the area of Baringo to administer, which is an area over 100 times the size of Malta, which also had as many more population. For 6 years, he was in charge there. He was the man totally in charge. He had a clerk to help him write. He was the judge. He was a tax collector. He was everything. So he had to have his clerk to write the pronouncements.
He managed it that way.
So you can imagine the ingenuity of doing all that when you can't read and write. Eventually, obviously, it came too much for him. You know, it probably got too more complicated, and then he moved more into industry.
At some point in his life, he got married too and settled down, it seems, with a family. Would you say that his family survives, or it has been lost over years?
He was fortunate. There must have been very few eligible young ladies to marry in that time. But he managed to marry the daughter of the doctor in Zanzibar, who was Portuguese. And she was a very pretty, petite Elvira was her name, and he married her, and they lived together. They set up a family. They had children. Had one child died initially, but the next daughter was born, and she was called Eldoma, which was named after the place where he lived, Eldama Ravine, which was his town. And she then married a man by the name of Winkler, and they were Portuguese, and there was some correspondence between them and my father when he was researching the thing. So where they are, I don't know, but I assume their family are surviving in Portugal.
That's part of the end of the book, where he ended up at the very end of his life. We don't know, anyhow, that any of his children took up his sort of career or the love for East Africa.
There's no evidence of that. I think they went back to Portugal and probably
settled
their lives there, yes.
They're more Europeans nowadays than Africans, so to speak.
Yes. Well, at the time he left about the 1920s, I think, Africa, which was the Great Depression, which was a difficult time in Africa for work and jobs. So they were probably encouraged to remain in Portugal.
Most of us in Malta remember reading more than anything else, the explorer De Bono, who must have lived more or less at the same time. Would you think, or have you come across in your research on James Martin, of any crossing each other, these two Maltese in Africa?
Yes, Martin explored Africa from the east coast of Africa, from Zanzibar into the mainland up to Uganda. De Bono explored Africa from the north, coming down the Nile, and he came to Uganda, but he never quite found the source of the Nile. So where he stopped was almost the area Martin stopped, so that I don't think they would have ever met. And I'm not sure they knew of each other.
Africa was so huge, and the territory doesn't lend itself to easy communication, especially if you're not looking for any other Maltese area. But it's also interesting how these two Maltese guys, in such difficult times, ended up in a continent which seemed very far away in those days.
Well, De Bono came down looking for the source of the Nile, I think, from the north. And he was very close to finding it. Then he gave up just when he was, I think, about 50 to 100 miles from his goal. So had he carried on in history, he'd be a different person.
Would have beaten everybody else.
That's right.
Which is interesting and amazing at the same time, how the Maltese manage to find themselves in such important areas at such important times, many times without a lot of planning as well.
Yes.
In the case of Martin.
Right. I think the Maltese have gone out and have had influence at different times, not only this. And it would be interesting to gather more stories about the Maltese who have left and how they've coped and the things they've done. I think that would be very interesting to get more literature in this vein.
In fact, it's a pity that James Martin could not leave any writings about his thinking. But most probably he must have been aware, also when he was still in Malta, of the difference of the British superiority, for example, empire builders, explorers, I mean,
yes,
merchants, everything. The strength of the British Navy was so huge, was so worldwide, that he must have been quite aware of that. Did you come across his thoughts in any way? Because unfortunately he couldn't leave any written document, right?
Well, he eventually was working in the British administration. He was one of their officers.
He became one of them?
Yes.
Climbed the whole ladder, sort of.
Yes, well, he was always put in at the very top. So he was one of them and then had to, I think, he had to face the whole sort of specialization. I mean, his competitors in his job would have been maybe Cambridge graduates. So you can see the difference between a Cambridge graduate to administer Africa, and he was sitting there who couldn't write. I mean, it's like chalk and cheese, where he could actually communicate with the people, but the graduates coming in obviously had all the knowledge and had the backing of their people behind them.
It's amazing.
So he had to give way. He obviously must have been quite conscious of that, but he must have been quite, I suppose, annoyed in a way, frustrated. He couldn't. I'm sure he thought, look, I can do this job. These people can't do it. Effectively kicked him out in the end because he couldn't meet their standards. Right. So he administered, you know, he witnessed sort of colonialization. And I think the way he did it was a lot better than the others were doing because they came in at the top. I mean, the history of the Kenyan and East African colonization.
Yeah. They banked on their superiority more than anything else.
And it became very fragmented. And eventually it didn't turn out too well in the end, really.
In fact, it's part of Africa's sad history, so to speak. Colonization there obviously didn't render them better in some things, in many things perhaps. But
there are pluses and negatives in that.
Exactly,
thing,
but not in the soul of
the nations. You'd like to have, I would like to have thought, had Martin's philosophy then been expanded by more people, it wouldn't have led to a fight in the end. There would have been a lot more compromise and understanding, and history would have been different.
Even different, perhaps, would have been the state of poverty, for example, the economic disasters in independent states in Africa, which has
been
taking so long, and yet it's not all over. So,
yes.
And again, that's a consequence of that kind of colonialism, that kind of exploitation, more than anything else.
Bil-qala wil-muqdir. Illum, Mark Policino, l-awtur tal-ktieb James Martin, The Maltese Adventurer, qed jintroduċilna lil dan il-karattru avventurier Malti tas-seklu 19. Komplu simgħu bil-qala u l-moqdif.
There is a theme in the book which we just briefly touched in our conversation today. It is slavery. And when Martin arrived, you told us that his Maltese, his Semitic language, his Arab original language, helped him communicate with these slave traders, who were mostly Arabs. Could you tell us something about what you found about this slave trade in East Africa by Arabs more than Europeans, so to speak, which was the case in the rest
slavery,
of
the world? Throughout the world, in East Africa, slavery had been run by the Portuguese, I think, and then the Arabs for many years, for about 300 years.
Arabs coming from the Yemen area or things like that,
Yemen,
I imagine.
Oman. Basically, they were taking slaves to run plantations for copra, for different crops that they were doing. They had slaves to run them. That was the business at the time. Slavery was then abolished, but the trading was abolished, but people could still hold slaves. And really, it was a terrible thing because it decimated tribes, because basically these slave traders went in and took people out of tribes.
In large numbers.
I mean, early 1800s, I think the figures are about 70,000 a year slaves were taken out, basically. So it was a massive industry as such. And Martin, one of his first jobs he was employed by the Christian Mission Society, CMS, to work in Frere Town.
Which was also present in Malta when the British came to Malta, right?
Yes.
The Christian Mission Society.
Yes. Yes, I think so. And they were in Zanzibar, and they had a town they set up called Frere Town on the coast, just south of Mombasa, which was for freed slaves, because they used to capture freed slaves from galleons and places from the traders, and they'd bring them to this holding place where they tried to teach them, rehabilitate them, and teach them trades and get them back into society and into their lives. And Martin was a sort of supervisor here initially, so he would have to have taken these people in, helped them, taught them things, and helped them. And in that, he met a lot of different tribes of the different people, and he must have talked to them and helped them. So he was very much against slavery because he was in it from the other side. And throughout his time, he
And it helped him gain a lot of respect from these freed slaves, so to speak.
Certainly, yes, and trust. Yeah, yeah. He learned their language, learned their culture, and they certainly looked up to him, yes.
Exactly.
And that was his introduction to Africa. That's why he learned the cultures and languages so well, and the tragedies as well that he must have witnessed. So he must have felt it and must have been quite against it. Very brave people, actually, British as well, who were fighting the slave traders in the area. People who were in ships and tried to attack the slave traders and get the slaves out. Very brave people who are hardly mentioned in history. There was quite a fight going on there. And of course, eventually they prevailed and slavery stopped. He was sort of in the middle of that whole thing, which is quite interesting.
Before leaving your book, which I recommend to our listeners, in a epilogue note about the book itself, I can't help not noticing that in Malta, after the French had left, it took another half a century for education to get started. We mentioned it when your ancestor,
that's right,
Pulicino, was involved. You mentioned Napoleon in other parts of your book, and that period interests me as well.
Yes.
Researching the 19th century, you can't help coming across Malta in the 19th century becoming a British colony after revolutionary France was,
yes,
so present.
That's right.
Did you form any takes on that? Because you seem to say this in your book with a certain chagrin. Education came late in Malta.
Yes, exactly. No. Well, I don't presume to be an expert in any way of Malta history of the 1800s, so, you know, I just know a bit about it. Looking at Martin's character and trying to find out why he didn't go to school, why he couldn't read and write, it led me to asking the question, well, what education was there in Malta? This was in about the 1860s. And I read there that education had just started with this Paolo Pulicino, who started the first schools. And then I said to myself, well, why wasn't so education late? Started earlier? And then I read back a bit, and then I found when the French were here, they actually had done exactly the same thing. They had set up schools
15.
For all, École Centrale. This was in 1798. And they actually banned the university and set up these, which was a...
The Central École. École Centrale was an equivalent of university. Right?
Yes. And
but 15 elementary schools.
Yes. You'd know more about it than me. So it was a time when there was education, and then the French were thrown out. I asked myself, why should... the common man, who is basically given the chance now of education for everyone, why should they rise up and throw the French out? Basically, they were cutting their future off, which they did. For another 50 years, nothing happened.
In education?
Yes.
Another 120 years in democracy.
That's right, until it set in. So that's very interesting. That needs, I think, re-examined why the French were thrown out, and was it really in the best interests of the Maltese at the time? Because basically... the whole fruits of the revolution Napoleon brought here, and he set up all the things. He banished slavery, which is one of the things. He banished the Inquisition. He set up these schools. He established, I think, the Napoleon Code in the law courts.
So he did equality among all citizens?
Yes. Yes, and I think he banished the nobility as well.
As well.
Which he felt were, I suppose he must have felt that they were
Well, he was representing the French Revolution, after all.
Yeah. It was one. So instead of them clinging on to the positives of the French Revolution, they threw them out. So
I like your take, and I do hope I have a publication coming out later on this year,
mm-hmm.
addressing the French period. So
well,
I hope I have some answers.
Reading. Yes.
One last reflection. I have you here, the author of A Maltese Who Lived and Made a Career in East Africa, and then you who followed in his steps as far as geography is concerned, so to speak. And this year is very close to Mandela's passing away, great symbol for African freedom. What are your reflections upon East Africa today? Because East Africa is all the time in the news because of Somalia more than anything else, also because of other things. But East Africa in particular, and the sea in that area, has stayed in the news for so long for negative reasons.
Yes.
Having spent so many years yourself living recently in that area, what do you think is the future for East Africa?
Well, living in East Africa, I often didn't, as a child, you often don't understand why things are happening. But researching the book of Martin, a lot of things that started in his day, colonialism and the consequences of colonialism, also the different fighting between tribes in Africa, which still goes on today, you can understand why it was going on in Martin's time. They were sort of fighting over part of the slave trade and so on and so forth. But understanding the conflict of his times gives you an indication of why things are happening today. And the fight for independence they had and so on. And those tribal fights they had in Martin's time are still, to a certain extent, happening today. There's still a rivalry over Kenyatta and Odinga. Odinga is from the Luo tribe, where Obama comes from. Kenyatta is from the Kikuyu tribe, which is in Nairobi. So politics is still tribal. It's still going on. They're still developing their democracy. There's still the whole position of women needs a lot of development to have equality with women there. It's working slowly, certainly, and I think doing a lot better than a lot of countries in Africa, quite a lot of prosperity there. But it's an ongoing development, which was sort of kicked off in Martin's time and will still take years, I think, to work out.
With your background, with your research, how do you see the role of Europeans, ex-colonizers, but also the West? How could the West help this development to make it happen earlier? Do you think what is being done now by the United Nations, the World Bank, by people who seem to want to help Africa develop, including China nowadays, right, which invested hugely in that continent, do you think they are doing the right thing, or just retaining their old colonial ways under a different blanket today, perhaps, under a different...
That's very interesting, and I'm sure I don't really have all the answers to that. I think you're right. In researching this book, true development came from an equality in development of helping at the grassroots. And I know a lot of NGOs and people do that today. Must be very powerful in helping. Obviously, the other, a more formal structure from the top, perhaps doesn't always help the development. The countries themselves have their own structures. I mean, they, to a certain extent, they took over colonial structures. So you have the overseers and the people. So it's a difficult question, you know. It's part of Malta's legacy as well, because a lot of these economies are not doing well, and the people are coming to Europe to find jobs, and this is the problem we have on our doorstep. So it is a problem Malta should engage in, I think, a lot more. And Malta, being the European country closest to Africa, should start looking to Africa and understand what's happening to be able to solve this problem, which is Europe's problem now in the next 10, 20 years.
Thank you.
għen naslu fit-tmiem ta' dik il-laqa interessanti mhux tas-soltu wkoll ma' Dr. Mark Pulicino li huwa l-awtur tal-ktieb James Martin, The Maltese Adventurer, li minn xkejken telaq mill-kottonera biex qattaħajtu l-biċċa l-kbira fl-Afrika tal-Lvant. Sikemm nerġgħu nitaqgħu l-ġimgħa d-dieħla minn ħatija ċas xwieqeb insemmikom.